Good morning. This is Talking Animals on WMNF. I'm Duncan Strauss. And on this sort of pre-Earth Day edition, my guest today is Phil Janney, Executive Director of the Wildlife Rehabilitation Center, or WRC, in Minnesota. Founded in 1979 at the University of Minnesota as a student club of the Veterinary College, WRC has evolved into what's considered the world's busiest wildlife hospital, admitting approximately 19,000 patients each year. WRC expects they will see more than 190 different species across that year, and there's a staff of 31 people to do so. There's also a sprawling battalion of volunteers numbering around 600 that helps look after the WRC patients in various ways. We'll seek his perspective on the WRC produced by his 20-plus years running the facility, and more broadly, somewhat less personally, I guess, the 40-plus years of the center's existence, when I speak with Phil Janney in a few moments here on Talking Animals on WMNF. Later in today's program, I was going to speak with Rochelle Stewart, Executive Director of Tiny Acres Northwest Florida, a horse rescue in Santa Rosa County. Santa Rosa County being where an awful incident occurred last week. Sorry, I'm just getting an update from Rochelle herself as we speak. I'm sorry, because it looked like she was going to be unavailable tending to horses in her rescue, and she might still be available for the phone call, so we're going to getting that message now. I'm so sorry. But anyways, to back to what I was saying, this awful incident happened last week in Santa Rosa County. You might have heard about or read about a donkey named Jack had gotten loose and ultimately was shot and killed by an independent livestock contractor ostensibly dispatched to capture the animal. Though not directly involved, Stewart wrote a Facebook post that reflected familiarity with the various entities, a sharp perspective, and a powerful sense of outrage that has really escalated wildly in the days since this animal was killed. And there was a press conference yesterday. The man that killed the donkey has retained an attorney, and the attorney delivered a press conference. So anyway, it's quite a story. And it looks like Rochelle may well be available to speak with us after all, so we'll sort of hope for that later in today's show. Right now, though, let's talk large-scale wildlife rehabilitation with Phil Janney, with a reminder that I invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, email dj at wmnf.org, or text 813-433-0885. This is Phil Janney back on Talking Animals on WMNF. Good morning, Phil.
For having me on, and also for your work on behalf of animals. I love looking at your website and following the show whenever I can. So thanks for your work.
Well, thank you, Phil. And again, much the same could be said for you. I think you've been running the center, leading the center a hair longer, or maybe a bit longer than a hair longer, but around the same time that I've been doing the show. So the same thank you could go right back to you. In fact, we spoke on the show, I guess, about 9 years ago, and it's so great to speak with you again. And I look forward to reviewing WRC's history and addressing some nuts and bolts of the operation. But first, an intriguing detail. As I noted in the introduction, the center considers itself the world's busiest wildlife hospital. How exactly is that measured?
Well, we that's as near as we can find out from looking at patients admitted. So it's not how many are released or how many species.
It's coming through the doors, I guess, right?
Is that coming in through the doors? Yeah. And that are legitimately wildlife species, as we call it, with a breeding season in whatever the locale is.
And so, is there?
We don't know.
Yeah. So sorry, I didn't mean to jump in there, but I was going to say, based on that extended definition, is there some criteria that where a line is drawn? Like, this is wildlife, and over here is close to wildlife, but isn't quite qualify for the purposes of statistics, et cetera?
Yeah, we do. Yeah. And especially in a place like Minnesota, where there's a lot of ducks, and there's a lot of domestic ducks, and people raise ducks. You can go to a feed store and buy ducks, and some of those get loose, and it's always kind of a challenge to know which ones are domestic and which ones are wild. We do our best to make sure that the only patients that we care for are legitimate native wild species. It's interesting. We get big tortoises every now and then. Somebody might have had them as a pet, and somebody else sees them outside, and they don't know anything about them, so they just pick them up and bring them into us. so we work with a lot of other partners, the Herpetological Society, and there's some avian rescue places, you know, people's parrots get out, and a lot of times people don't know where to go with them, so they bring them to us, and we help place those patients. So we're looking at our numbers solely from the numbers of wild animals that are in need of medical care.
Right. And it sounds like from what you've described, sometimes well-meaning people, I'm guessing, occasionally are bringing in animals that aren't really wild by that definition, just but they see some animal out there that looks like it's in distress or injured or ill or something and say, well, I know where to take it. And then they end up there as well. So
yeah, no, that's right. We call that the Good Samaritan syndrome. We kind of want to just tell them, take it back. But they, you know, we have an allowance, I guess, for that. The person wants to help, you know.
Sure. And,
so if we have to be the middleman, so be it. But as we've gotten busier, some of that's been harder and harder. You know, we got all we can do to keep track of the 19,266 patients we admitted last year.
Wow. Yeah, well, that's the thing. The Good Samaritan thing, I've probably been sort of guilty of it myself, because if you live somewhere where there's even a bit of wildlife kind of brushing up against where you live, wildlife of one kind or another does end up kind of in your direct proximity. And then sometimes if there's, often a baby that you think, this baby's in trouble and or been abandoned by your mom. Now, you later learn that, generally speaking, your first instinct in that case is actually wrong. It's sort of counterintuitive to what should be done. But you have to go through some well-meaning mistakes, usually, to get that kind of understanding.
Yeah, and we've actually pioneered a program called what we call, it's Rehome, we call it. And we actually offer the service for people to, like, a nest of baby bunnies is exactly what you're talking about. And you see this nest out in your yard, the parents never come to the nest that you see. Your dog, you know, sniffs it out. And your first instinct is to try to help it and bring it into us. And what we do is we actually, we have a veterinarian on call that deals with all of our, or on duty that deals with all of our admits, and we will actually examine the animal, check its belly, see if it's got milk in it, and if it looks otherwise healthy and a full belly, we actually send it home with the people, the nest back home, and just put it back where you found it and leave it there. Now, when we started that, I was convinced that a lot of people take bunnies out of their yards because they don't want to deal with the hassle of keeping their dog or kids out of the nest.
Right.
But what I found is I was wrong, and almost all the people who go through this rehome thing willingly take them back and put them in their yard and put laundry baskets over the nest and all kinds of things. And so it really kind of reinforced my growing suspicion that what we do is all about compassion.
Yeah, everybody has their threshold, I guess, of good Samaritan, do-gooding kinds of task, and especially if that requires a long list of care and maintenance of the animal that you brought in earlier this afternoon. It's like, well, I wasn't really bargaining for that. I thought I was just doing the right
exactly.
thing, right? Yeah,
exactly.
So, and I guess I almost have to ask, before we move on to some other stuff, what facility is considered the world's second busiest?
I'm not really sure. We know there's a place in England that has, that we know of 14,000 patients that they admit.
Well, that's a big drop, though, from 19 plus to 14. That's still...
Yeah. And there's a large center in Southern California, and I think that there's a couple reasons, I think, where, you know, Minneapolis, St. Paul dominates the upper Midwest in terms of people. So very few of our compatriots in this business are located in large urban areas. Most of them are associated with vet clinics, and most vet clinics are at the universities, usually the state university.
Yeah.
And there's nobody else anywhere near us. The closest place that, and I think Milwaukee takes in, I don't know, 3,000 to 5,000 animals a year. So, and it's 6 hours to Milwaukee from here. So we cover a very large geographic area.
Yeah.
Florida itself has probably a dozen big centers. So I think that's, we're partly a, I don't know if I want to call it a victim, but of geography.
Yeah, product, it sounds like. Because it sounds like it's geography plus tied to geography, like a huge array of species are in and around there. So if anybody's not doing well or gets injured or whatever, that's the potential base of patients there, I guess, is just naturally gigantic.
Yeah, and that's the other. Minnesota in the upper Midwest is very, very conscious of its natural resources. So so even if you're a hunter, you're usually compassionate about an injured animal. So that's the other thing, because of the fact that there's so many lakes and ponds, and we're in one of the world's largest flyways in the Mississippi River Flyway. Just a lot of stuff comes our way.
So let's you kind of touched on something that made me think, because of some talking about some of the other centers that are hooked into universities. Let's talk a bit of history, because there's a long arc here spanning, by one permutation or another, 40 some years, but not really a direct path. So walk me through how it began, how it unfolded, and some of the key milestones of those four decades.
Sure. We started, as you mentioned, in 1979 as a student organization at the University of Minnesota Vet School. A couple years before that, there were some faculty members, one of Falconer, Dr. Pat Rettig, he and his partner Gary Duke, started the Raptor Center at the University of Minnesota Vet School, which is still part of the University Vet School to this day. And there were students at the time who thought, well, yeah, it's great we're taking care of these raptors, but what about all these animals in the backyard? You know, what about squirrels and rabbits, and aren't they worthy of saving as well?
Right.
And so we started in 79, and in our first year we admitted 45 patients. And that's kind of a slow morning for us
wow.
these days. And it kind of just it grew gradually as a student organization, but more and more it kind of morphed into a larger community-based organization. You know, it started out, it was just students at the U who were volunteers. Gradually, people from the community started to volunteer. And then the university went through one of the periodic times when it goes back and tries to think about what does it do, and they decided that they were going to cut back on some of these centers that they had and student organizations. So this was in 1996, so, you know, however, 17 years after its founding, they booted us out, frankly.
Not to put too fine a point on it. Yeah. Okay.
Right. And they gave us a period we stayed on campus, but the organization split off as a separate 501c3. So 1996 is actually our, is defined by the IRS code anyway, when we became a nonprofit organization.
I see.
And you know, there's a lot of fits and starts, we also were in the building trying to find a new building off campus, and then there was kind of, you know, just really bad growth problems in that period, and the previous ED kind of went off the rails, and I was hired in 2002 to coordinate the fundraising and building of the new building that we still reside in, and then also to do the fundraising and generally put the organization on sound nonprofit organizational footing.
I see.
And then we moved in 2003 to our new building. When we designed it, we thought it would accommodate comfortably about 10,000 animals. So we're out of space now, and we're involved in another very large, it's a $10 million capital campaign that we'll be kicking off here shortly. We bought some land near the Twin Cities, in the suburb. And, I've always believed that there's really two parts to our mission, really, or of our business, if you will. There is the emergency care for wild animals, right? That's the bird that flies into your window, or, you know, something that your dog gets, and then there's the, what, what I call the rehab business. That's the baby bunnies and squirrels and the unfortunate orphans who really don't need, a high-end medical center. They just need space and room to grow up and learn to be whatever they are. And it's always been interesting to me. It's sort of like going to the emergency center with a cold. And so our vision now is to have a fully separate rehabilitation campus with sprawling cages and underground in-ground pools and all that sort of thing, while we keep and repurpose our current building, which is full of baby animals, repurpose that building to be what it was really designed as a really first class emergency hospital for wild animals. We have a very robust teaching program. We have as many as a dozen to 20 veterinary students that come through our facility each year as, in various parts of their career, most often in their fourth year. And then we have a vet intern program where it's actually an already minted vet who doesn't necessarily, they know they're going to take care of cats and dogs the rest of their life, right? So they want to do something more interesting in the beginning. So the point being that then that the current WRC facility will be the teaching hospital.
Oh, wow.
And the rehabilitation center will be where we have the space to provide sufficient caging and all of the other things that you need when you prepare an animal, whether it was injured and now healthy or orphaned, to prepare that animal for success in the wild.
So there's basically two tracks, broadly speaking, that an animal comes in as a patient, and now or eventually there'll be two separate buildings that'll sort of look after them. Do I follow this?
Well, yeah, that's right. And yeah, that's exactly right. Not everybody will need to go out to the rehab campus, but oftentimes that will be necessary. You think of large migratory birds, for instance. We get a lot of trumpeter swans. Well, it's really when we have a trumpeter swan in the wintertime, we don't really have the ability to house it properly at our that hospital. It really needs to be in a larger outdoor space.
A lot of times,
I always think it's funny, people think that they'll get cold if they're outside. And then you remind them that, well, what's your coat made out of?
Right, yeah. No need to bring that sweater by. I think we'll be okay. Yeah.
Right, so.
Well, this sounds really great. Well, this, for folks who might just be tuning in, this is Talking Animals. If you did just tune in, my guest is Phil Jenny, Executive Director of the Wildlife Rehabilitation Center of Minnesota, that, as we've been discussing, is considered the world's busiest wildlife hospital, admitting approximately 19,000 or more patients each year. If you'd like to ask Phil a question or offer a comment about wildlife, about maybe some kind of wildlife that you have recently found or figured out or wondered, hey, what would I do or what should I do if this happens or I see this kind of bird or raccoon or whatever, kind of on my yard or doorstep, feel free to call 813-239-9663, email dj at wmnf.org, or text 813-433-0885. So the very nature of what you've described and how sprawling, well, increasingly sprawling the facilities will become when the other new building is up and running, but also just how sprawling the patient intake numbers are, I don't suppose there's anything resembling a typical day over there. So, but still, just to give us some sort of flavor, some sort of specifics, let's say I do find either an injured or, well, I think it's injured, at least raccoon, like a small, probably as a baby to my eyes, whether it is or not, I'm not sure. I call up the Wildlife Rehabilitation Center of Minnesota, then sort of walk me through what would often or typically happen at that, from those stages forward.
Yeah, if the client actually calls us ahead of time, we'll try to help them as much as we can in the preparation and also give them advice about whether they really need to come in. So that's always good when they call us first. But we also have clients who just show up.
Yeah.
Especially people.
I know where to take this and I'm taking it now.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. No matter what.
Yeah.
So then they get to the center, and once they get to our center, and actually this is COVID related, we had greeters out in front of the building. So we didn't actually bring people into the building. And during the COVID summer, that first summer particularly, we gave people those restaurant, your tables ready, little buzzer things.
Oh, okay, sure.
And then it worked out very well. We had these people lined up in the parking lot, and when their buzzer rang, then they could be admitted into the building because we were only taking in three people at a time. And so we're still working on that. We used to just, you know, you'd bring the animal in. There would be one person behind the desk. They'd do all the paperwork, check it in. And, you know, you've driven an hour with this animal and you drop it off and the person's got their head down at the desk and thank you. off you go. So what we did is we've actually expanded our intake staff so that there is somebody, and we've automated it now too. We have laptops. So when somebody comes in, the form, they fill out the form themselves right on the laptop. So three or four people can be admitting animals at the same time. It goes right into our database.
Oh, great.
And then that also gives us a chance to relate to those people because, you know, we try to care for the clients, the customers, as well as we do the animals.
Sure.
Because if you think about it, that's a pretty extraordinary thing that they're doing is to bring an animal in. So that's the first stage is at that point. Then the animal will go back. The mantra in wildlife medicine is warm, dark, and quiet. So we'll put the animal in an intake room, and we'll actually let it sit there for a bit so it can calm down. You know, it's been picked up, it's been driven in a car, you know, it's been handled. And there isn't a single animal at WRC that wants to be there. It's not like a pet clinic or us going to the hospital.
Yeah.
They all think we're going to eat them. And so then they... Then what will happen is every single animal that comes in, no matter how small, big, or sick, gets an admission exam by a trained veterinarian in wildlife medicine. So then at that point, the options are several. Sometimes, in fact, quite often, the animal that comes into us is not going to survive and it's suffering or it has an injury that means it won't survive in the wild, and humane euthanasia is the treatment option for that animal, and that actually happens about 30% of the time. And then, okay, so it makes it through that period. Then it goes, if it's an orphan baby squirrel or rabbit or mammal, it goes into what we call our mammal nursery. Those are staffed by rehab experts, and also we have about 70 college age interns too who work with us in those nurseries. If it's an adult animal, we also have a variety of different wards for whether it's a predator or a prey. You don't want to put the rabbits next to the fox. So
the voice of experience, apparently.
Right. And then we'll, you know, it'll be there any number of days, monitored, you know, put on meds, whatever.
Yeah.
And then ultimately the goal is our first goal is to relieve suffering.
Yeah.
So, but then the second goal is to really release the animal back in the wild where it was found in a way that it can function in the wild.
Sure.
So that's kind of the clients also have an option of following up and keeping track of their patient as it goes through the process, and we do status reports. So we have a full-time person in the summer who all they do is respond to what we call status reports, either by phone or email. So we try to be transparent, as you'd expect, with a lot of animals that come in and a lot of animals that need to be euthanized can also lead to, you know, a lot of clients will just say, well, it looks perfectly healthy. You know, why did you euthanize him? Well, in the wild animals will not show any kind of stress.
Sure. They don't want to be vulnerable, I guess, right?
Yeah, that's right. It's a death sentence. So, you know, that's part of our job, too, is to communicate with the clients something about wildlife medicine. And we do that through our Facebook page, which we think is quite unique in that we don't mind sharing surgery stories with the public that follows us.
Yeah.
by Facebook. It's not just fuzzy animal stuff, you know.
Right.
It's a hospital.
The good, the bad, the ugly. Yeah, for better or worse. Yeah.